Hey there.
Hey, how are
How's
you?
it going? I'm good. How are
Good.
you?
Good. I'm at one end of the house here, so hopefully I got enough Wi-Fi.
Yeah, if you lose Wi-Fi, it gets kind of messy.
Right.
I think Adam will join us here in a minute. He said he was ready.
Right. Let me get the dog out of there. Get out of there. So I see Midwest was dates got changed.
Yeah, I think the entire universe on track got messed up. Not just Grid Life, it was pretty much everybody.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you start changing the Indy 500 and Le Mans, then that lets you know the game is not the usual. We're still waiting for a spa. That's with SRO spa 24 hours to get changed. So
Oh yeah.
yeah.
I saw that Chin was going to be back on track here at the beginning of the month.
Well, yesterday, well, actually today, Georgia, Carolina, and Tennessee did a partial opening. And from what I get out of Daytona, if Charlotte happens with NASCAR in this next coming race, and if Governor Cuomo allows Watkins Glen to run in July, then where everybody's back in business at that point. So,
Yeah.
but no spectators. So, guys that are hoping to break even, not lose money on a track rental, might need, the income from 2 or 3,000 spectators,
Right. Yeah. So, what have you been up to this off season?
Fortunately, we have 14 acres. So gardening and working around the property and working on some other stuff. Are we on tape now or not?
Yeah, you are, but I'll
Okay.
probably crop and do whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
Speak your mind, Gary.
what's that?
Speak your mind.
Yeah, to a point. Working around the property a lot. I mean, there's not much to do. We were in the SRO world. We were totally dialed in. And when this got pulled at St. Pete, the governor, they went in and canceled the Gator Nationals or postponed them and so all the other events. And from what we understand, Mr. Pinsky, Mr. France, talked to the governor of Florida, and it was decided to allow St. Pete to happen if we went through, jumped through a couple of hoops. Everybody had to be temperature checked in the morning. You had to have a hard car. There were no spectators, and the teams were all fine for that. I mean, we were there. So
Right.
didn't really
At that
matter.
point, the money's kind of already been spent, or at least most of it.
The money's been spent, and if you're going to get infected, you're infected,
Right.
So we all decided to do it. We started practice on that Friday. They redid the schedule a little bit. And we were actually, it was about 10:30, I think we were in the middle of our first GT4 practice session, and the track official walked over and said, throw the checker. And we go, what do you mean? He goes, we're done. So fortunately for us, we didn't tear anything up. The session before us, I think they had three red flags in a 30-minute session and wrote off three cars.
Brutal.
So you hate to see that for a team because there's no reason to do that other than exuberance from the drivers,
Looks
And
like Adam's here on the call too.
Hey
yeah,
guys.
okay, hey Adam.
How do I sound? Any good?
Yeah, same as usual.
Yeah, okay. I'm not using my earpiece, so.
Like the crooner that you are.
Yeah, the it's as terrible as can be expected, right?
So I didn't
Good.
have a
Hey.
chance to re-listen to the Gary episode number one. I don't remember what we talked about, but Gary's life story, I think, needs more discussion.
We talked about a lot of, I mean, some of the old days stuff. I remember Adam saying that he wanted to talk about more about Le Mans at that point, but you know, there's a, I mean, there's current stuff and there's old stuff. It depends. I mean, one of the things I'm working on now is, and I can't get into too much detail, but is a couple of one a documentary and then a docudrama. And it's really getting some legs on it now, dealing kind of with that, as we call it, the cowboy days of IMSA, that late 70s up to middle, late 80s kind of thing. That was fairly exciting time. A lot of fun was going on, but a lot of stuff that would still be considered illegal was going on.
Yeah, that's cool. Abe, are you recording right now? I don't think Anchor doesn't record, right?
Yeah, we're live.
Okay. What? So I guess we should just like start, unless you guys already started.
We've just been chatting, but we're online.
So. Right. I would love to talk about the last couple of years of what you've been doing, and then see where it goes. So. Yeah.
Okay. I think last year, you know, was when you get to a point where I am and you try to fill as many weekends as you can without having a real job, you know, it really is. I mean, I say that, but I also I think I did 10 events in 11 weeks.
Yeah, that's busy.
And I did almost 11,000 miles with my truck and travel trailer.
Yeah, was it on the way to GridLife Midwest? You blew out like all the tires and ruined the fender on your trailer.
Oh, it's one of those things where you couldn't pull over, and the tire, you know, went up through the fender well and took out the plumbing.
In the house,
you know, when I pulled over and I opened up the door to go, hey, I see a hole up there. And then you see shredded rubbers up inside the bedroom.
Yeah.
It's about, fortunately, we discovered, I think that year, I think last year I did three high speed tire explosions, which goes off, at like a 50 caliber sniper rifle.
Yeah, when they blow. I've blown a lot of trailer tires in the last 400,000 miles of work and towing and everything.
Yeah,
that whole thing. Sometimes they pop.
Coming out of Elkhart Lake, going through Milwaukee with construction, the potholes, and then trying to sneak through Chicago, and I would always try to do that Sunday night to kind of beat the traffic, and it's pretty hard. Pretty hard on tires and sidewalls.
Yeah, when they go, they explode.
Yeah, so we did, I think, 5 GridLife events last year, and we picked up SRO, the old PWC series, and that's actually turned into my main gig this year. I'm of course. Which I'm the guy on the radio, and I'm the guy that makes sure that the track and the platform and the time schedule and everything is set for mm-hmm. each event. And then we have individual race directors that come in and we run the race, and myself and Bill Armitage and a couple of ladies out of Portland work and developed a real good system. And with Brian Hayes, we've got a series of scripted. I mean, what's important when you get at that level is, especially when you have all these different series that are going out, is that, you know, everything you're saying on the radio is the same. It's the same on Thursday. It's the same on Friday. It's the same on Saturday and Sunday. So that new teams come in, and the thing they hear on that first time that they're on the series radio is going to be the same thing when they're running a top car going for the win in GT3, you know. So a lot of development there, a lot of really severe clock watching, you know. I mean,
Adam, he's like, he and his team are like an infinitely more qualified version of you and me.
I think we try to cram more stuff per hour on the track.
Yeah, nobody does. All right. Nobody does more than you guys do on track. But, you know, you learn a lot of things. And when you're trying to be at that level, I mean, you don't key the mic at 9:35 and 20 seconds. You key it at 9:35 and 18 seconds so that you start talking at 20 seconds and build in the mic delay. And it sounds insane, but you know, we have beyond a minute by minute, it goes down to a second by second when you're getting ready to start, you know, pro races, you know. And so having all of that and keeping track of that and being able to adjust when there's an incident or the track is damaged or, you know, three or four cars are sitting on the roofs on fire.
Three or freaking S2000 blows and puts oil down all over the
track. Exactly.
Three or four at the same time. That's a bad day.
I still think of the guy, I think it was a hysterical race at the, possibly at the Midi at Road Atlanta, and up at the hairpin, a guy popped his motor at turn six, and he dumped oil all the way down the back straightaway, all through 10A, 10B, all out into the pit. He was in the outside paddock, and we actually followed it to his trailer.
Gee.
And I said, "What, you know, do you have a 40-gallon oil pan? You know,
yeah, seriously, that's a mile and a half.
The rod broke. The rod broke and must have just done this, you know, pinhole in the pan and had enough pressure inside that just sprayed. I think that weekend we used 65 bags of oil dry.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I don't know what our record is, but I think it was 35. I think at a 4-day event.
So we've got that. I'm hoping that we do these events with Grid Life if the world kind of gets back to a little bit of normality. Dave and I were talking about it. The word out of Daytona yesterday was if the NASCAR event happens in Charlotte, which the Carolinas and Georgia and Tennessee are doing a partial opening starting today, and then again on Monday is the next step. If that happens, and then the New York governor allows Watkins Glen race to happen, the 6-hour for the IMSA guys in July, then I think everybody's kind of back in business. The only thing that the downside about that is, you know, for guys that are renting the track, if you're not allowing spectators to come in, and even if you get 1,500 ticket buying spectators, in some of these cases, without a renegotiation of the contract, that would mean the difference of breaking even or making a little bit of money or losing money at that time. So I think on these bigger events, I mean, I know NHRA, you know, moving the Gator Nationals to the fall at some point is what the rumor is. Indy being moved to the fall. I mean, the fall and the winter, the off season, there's no off season now.
No.
So I think talking to a couple of the team managers in the DPI cars in the last couple of days, it's a concern of how to get most of their contracts are set on 9 events.
Right.
How to jam in 9 events at that point without being just insane, you know.
without wanting to kill yourself.
Yeah, how you're going to do Petite and then go out and try to do Long Beach and then turn around and come back and do Sebring. You'll have the guys go on strike at that point. But, you know, when you look at pro guys that are tied into contracts and you're not going to get whatever their sponsorship is. You don't deliver, they don't pay. You know, that's how that is.
So, yeah, the time is strange, man.
It really is. It really is. And Abe and I talked about it before you got on. We were at St. Pete's, and we agreed with everybody. And I think Mr. Penske and Mr. France had gotten on the a call with the governor and said, okay, the teams are here. We've got TV. We've got our live feed. We're all set to go. We'll just stop the spectators from coming in. We won't sell any tickets. And the teams will go through a temperature check in the morning, and you have to have a hard card to come in. And we were fine with that. You know,
yeah.
We said, what's the sense of us going home? We've all been together for a couple of days already. So if you're infected, you're infected. But at that
ship
point,
already sailed.
Yeah, I think at that point, we were actually in our practice, and the track official came over and said, wave the checker. You guys are done. Pack it up.
That's crazy.
So we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of people. The concern that I think a lot of the series have and a lot of team owners have is, what do you do? How do you take care of the contract? It's really, in my mind, it's the contractors, the outside contractors. I can say for myself, you're screwed, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
you got nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're talking now that you can get some 1099 help, or for a 1099 contractor, some unemployment help on that. But one of the guys I work with, I think he had 35 weekends booked between five different series.
Wow.
And now none of those weekends are happening yet, you know. So
yeah.
We went from, you know, almost St. Pete in March. We went from March. So into March, April, May, June, maybe July. So
yeah, a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. And guys, I spoke with Peter Barron at StarWorks, you know, for StarWorks last week. And, you know, Peter's, nobody runs a pro team on a smaller shoestring than Peter can. And he said that, I don't have any full-time guys in the shop anymore. But he said, I make my money renting equipment and renting tractor trailers and renting ore wagons and renting da-da-da-da-da. And he said, nobody's renting.
No, there's no use for it right now.
No renting. So, you know, it's really a weird anomaly for this to happen right now. And I hate to see it, you guys moving Midwest. I mean, there's always a concern when you start moving into the fall for motor racing. As you get up, you start going up against college football or NFL. And, you know, we hope that the racing fans and the populace that deals with what we do is more interested in that than it is, you know, sitting in the stands at the, you know, 20-yard line watching something. But
one of my concerns about Midwest being in October now is, you were at at that weekend. Well, yeah, you were at that weekend 2 years ago. Were you there this year too? I forget. Last year?
Yeah, last year I came for that.
And we had so much fog, you could hardly see your hand in front of your face for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you guys are far enough north, going into October, it could snow.
Yeah, it could. It could also be 70 and perfect.
And that's the crazy part about it. So, but you know, chances are it's going to be cold. So, everybody bring a jacket. You know, bring a pad to sleep on. It's still going to be a lot of fun. And I tell you, when we had the Lemons race at Road Atlanta for the finale, the first year, it snowed like hell, and the guys were out there having fun, and the only thing that we did before the race is make sure there wasn't any ice in any of the low spots, and the rest of it was like you had a little guardrail around you, you know, you had a 6-inch white guardrail. And I tell you, from a social media standpoint, I think in 48 hours, There were over 140,000 shares and likes on that, more than anything that ever happened because it was so unique.
Yeah, and they had, Champ Car had it there this this spring, I think. They actually had to red flag the race at Road Atlanta. I forget what month, but it was like February. They had to red flag because it was snowing so hard you couldn't see in Atlanta, you know.
But you know, guys, right? And it's rare for us to have snow, especially when it sticks like that, like the thing a couple years ago. But you know, at the end of the day, for a lot of the non-pro events, it's about having fun and having a good experience, and that's. Yeah. You know, a little bit of weather for guys that have never driven, you know, like in the rain. Okay, well, you know, it's good practice. Get out there and drive in the rain. And the only way to get better, to be a better wet driver is to drive in the wet.
Right.
As long as you don't tear anything up.
Yeah, you've been a lot of places. What was like the worst weather, like at Le Mans or at Sebring or Daytona? Like, what was the worst you ever had to deal with when you were pro teams? And stuff?
I would say Japan. You know, there was Fuji, and let me digress for a second. There was a fun thing. There's a group of old guys on Facebook, and we had a competition of who had worked at, you couldn't count this as a spectator, but who had worked at either racing or been there part of the crew or something, how many racetracks you've been to. And last year I made 100, but we kept going. We know that Tony Dow used to run Walkinshaw's effort here, and Tony's down in Australia running supercars, V8 supercars now. And when Tony came back up, he had I think he was at 166.
I didn't even know there were that many.
Oh, yeah. You know, when you start talking about, you know, back in 65, I was with F2 at O and things like that. So, but Japan has historically horrible weather. The fall race at Fuji, I remember in, I believe it was 85, the world championship race. And I think Formula One did this as well one time in Japan with Lada, and everybody came in and said, we're not going to do this. But we started the race under the pace car, and you could not see. You could not see the front straightaway, and you had a little window that was right in front of us that you could hear the cars coming at and go by. So we took the green flag under the pace car, and I think the second lap by under the pace car, all the Porsche teams came in. Third lap by, the Jags came in. Fourth lap, fourth lap or whatever, the next European teams came in. And I'll give the Japanese drivers credit. They were used to it, and all the Toyotas and Nissan Group C cars, they turned them loose, and those guys raced with it, and it was, you know, bonsai baby. I mean, it was wild. It was wild. And then one time at the new Nürburgring as well, I think it was about 33 degrees, and it spit snow, and then the fog came in, and there was a massive crash. Everybody was behind the pace car, and of course most people didn't have radios, or the radios didn't work, and it was so bad that you had like Hans Stuck driving the factory Rothmans 962 with a stick, like a little mop, inside the car, and he'd loosen his belts and lean forward to try to you know, get the mist off the inside of the windshield, even though they had heated windshields on the 962.
And really, it was that bad.
And I remember everybody was behind the pace car. He came in, did a pit stop, and was trying to catch the field. And the field had slowed down for some reason because people started hydroplaning on the straightaway. And he came shooting by, and everybody was out at the Armco on the straightaway trying to get him to slow down. And he hit, I think it was Moss, hit Jochen Moss. And basically, if you had run Moss's car down a giant bandsaw and it didn't get the tub, but it took off, you know, hit him in the rear, took the rear suspension off, took the coolers, everything off the side, took the, you know, the front suspension off, and just sliced it down the side. But fortunately, nobody got hurt.
You know, Hans Stuck and Jochen Maas, Jochen you Maas. Saw the car get cut in half.
Yeah. It cut a third of it off, let's say.
Okay.
But didn't you couldn't have cut it any, you know, couldn't cut it any straighter. It was incredible. But fortunately, nobody got hurt. But those two stick out in my mind. I mean, Sebring, you know, you would occasionally get the dog just squeaked the toy. Occasionally, we've had water 5 inches deep running down the pit lane at Sebring, where you would make little boats and write notes on it, and you would sit there and you know watch that. But you know, it is what it is. You know, it's the same for everybody at that point. And you know, when you look at when you race in conditions like that, you start to understand why, as a series. You know, you say there's one dry tire, there's one wet tire. You know, if I go back to mid to late 80s when we were the first at Brun Motorsports, we were the first Group C car to have Michelins. We had two kinds of intermediates. We had three kinds of rain tires. We had a rain tire that the tread depth was probably almost 3/8 of an inch or even deeper, you know, so. We had an unfair advantage besides just having Michelins. We could dial in what kind of rain tire we wanted to use. So you start to understand some of that stuff. But anyway, that's different than the weather.
Gary, can you give us think of a story, anything from back in the day, where your team tortured the rule book and found a loophole or did something that was like right on the cusp of being banned, but somehow you got away with it?
Well, let's talk about the ones that we want to talk about. Let's think about that. Yeah. I mean, when I was with Brun in 86 to 89, we had at one point three cars, 956 to 962s, that we ran in the World Championship. We ran them in Inter Series in Europe, and then also a series called Super Cup that was the precursor to DTN at that point. And then we also had a car in the States, and we had a car in that we were keeping in Japan. But when one of the things that was the width of the car and or the height of the car. So you knew the higher you could put the wing up, the better it worked because it was in cleaner air and gave you a better balance on the car. And also with the Porsche, the wider the dive planes that you could have. So we would go through tech and be legal. And then when we would start the race, like 24-hour race, so you're not going to be pulled into tech at that point. We would start the 24-hour race. The dive plane would be wider on the front. And not dramatically wider, but wider that the driver could feel it. And also the wing would be higher. So one year, I think we finished second in 24-hour. And the first thing that we did, and we had a marshal that's standing, a pit official is standing there to go down with the car. So the next to the last stop, we actually fall down on purpose and break off the outside dive plane.
Way.
Yes. And break it completely off. There was no Kevlar in it. So break it completely off because we had a good enough gap on the third place car. They weren't going to catch us. I think we put Larari in the car. They weren't going to catch us anyway. And so we broke that dive plane off because the officials, the tech officials, would actually just go through and see what the total width was. And if the total width was fine, then they're not going to do the math and put the other thing together. And the other thing is the rear wing now was maybe, I would say 13, 15 millimeters higher than it should be. And they allowed us to change slicks to rain tires. And so we would change the rain tires, and we have a pit official sitting there watching us. Well, the rain tires had about 6 pounds of air in them.
Yeah.
So we knew from being on the pad that, you know, that was a low enough air pressure with that construction of tire at that point that
nice soft tire.
Yeah, that it would make the wing. And I tell you, it's these days, that's why when you go to tech now, there's a mandatory air pressure. You know, we have that at Thoreau, you have it at IMSA. That's because there's a lot of old guys like myself that have gone through this with teams that now work for the sanction body or the series and go, you know what? We can do this. We need to make these cars that come in here at, you know, at a proper air pressure.
Yeah, don't let any of those guys clumsily knock off the dive planes.
Yeah, we're going to bolt another one back on there and just see what it is. So it's
that's a good one.
there were other things as well. You know, fuel was, and if I go back to 935 days, we would do a sprint race. And I remember at Red Atlanta, we had Ray Hall in the 935 in 81. And this is something the Gerritsen guys with Dick Barber had come up with. You know, you would just go to the pits and you'd fill up the car with the fuel bladder. And it was just an old bag at that point that, you know, hung in a little hammock. And Jerry Woods, who I rate as one of the smartest guys I've ever worked with out in California. We've worked together and known each other since I was at Gerritsen in 81. And worked on all kinds of projects. Jerry goes, look, we're talking gravity. He says, we can't pressurize the rig. You know, it's just a vinyl Kevlar bladder. Let's put the fuel rig up on the top of the tailgate and raise the tailgate all the way. And so we would sit here, try to be the last guy on. And you can imagine now, we've got the rig. We actually had a longer hose on it. We've got the rig on the tailgate of the tractor trailer. So we've got, you know, 16, 18 feet of head going into the fuel tank. And you put the probe in that thing and the 935 had a fiberglass box that went around the fuel cell. And you would watch this box and you would hear it start to creak and, you know, swell out. We're going, okay. All right. Pull it quick, you know. But that was one of those things. The officials really would not have liked that. They'd known we were doing that kind of stuff. I mean, there's other stuff that we've done, but we don't really need to discuss that. There was a terrific thing in Amelia Island at the Concours event 2 years ago, I think. And they had some of the really top NASCAR guys that have been with I think it was Ray Abraham was there. And he brought a bunch of the old classic NASCAR cheater stuff, you know, the restrictor plate. And, you know, for the speedway, for the carburetor, and there was a little switch, and not a switch, just a little pull out. So as the tech official would look at the carburetor and he's measuring what the restrictor plate holes are. And then as you put the carburetor back on, there was a little key and you would pull that out and slide it out. And it would change the size of the holes. I mean, very, very cool stuff. You know, was it Smokey Unic or whatever? They took the fuel tank out, drained all the fuel out of the car, pulled everything
still ran.
Out they got, and then he says, "Are we done here?" And got in the car and turned the key. It started and it drove off. You know, so
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, you bunch of cheaters, man. Bunch of cheaters.
It's, you know, yeah, well, yeah, kinda,
I think a lot of the rules that are written nowadays, like if the torturation and like the pushing of the limits and everything, like if that hadn't happened, I mean, somebody else would do it. It had to happen at one time, you know, one time or another.
You know, one thing that was so fantastic, we used to call it Week of the Week, and Greg Eliff, who's running a restoration shop, was our team manager and a really sharp guy when I was at Garrison, and we did some other projects together in the years. But, you know, when you're sitting there and you anybody that wants to go fast and starts working on anything, whether it's a boat or it's a car or a bicycle or whatever it is, you sit there and stare at it, you know? Mm-hmm. And when we were doing the Mercedes a couple of years ago, the P1 car for Daytona, and, you know, Saturday night, Tuesday night at midnight, John Shapiro and myself would just sit there and, you know, the guys are gone or they're quietly eating or something like that. And you just sit there and stare at it and go, you know what? What about if we did this?
Yeah.
If we did this, you know, this would allow us to get the gearbox out in 20 minutes instead of an hour. And if we did that, we chopped this and did this, you know, and to be truthful, that's a lot of the direction where everybody's gone with homologation of cars and, you know, getting the manufacturers, the OEMs involved with it. So they'll pay money, stops us from doing a lot of that. So I had a conversation a couple of years ago with the IMSA guys that I said the fun, the innovation that we used to be able to do, you guys have taken all that out.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want us to do that. You can't do this thing. And there's stupid shit. Like, and again, I refer back to Jerry Woods when we had, water cooled cars, you always had to worry about, cause it was the quality of the coolers and things like that. We came up with the first fire extinguisher that was filled with water and a quick disconnect that you would come in during a pit stop and be able to plug that into the back of the car and add water under pressure, under pressure through the system, that would bleed it all out with enough pressure that it would pop the header tank cap. And so you know that you filled it back up again, because anybody that thinks that, you know, when the car is overheating, you're going to come in and I'm going to open up the header tank cap and pour water in it, you're kidding yourself. You're not doing anything. So they didn't even want us to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, and we're saying, but that allows us to keep racing. Yeah, but you might be putting fluids on the surface. Well, I get that as well. But you know what? At that time, you know, you're at war when you're in a big endurance race like that, and you do whatever you can do to, you know, to get the car to the finish line.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the fabulous fixes?
Yeah. That adding pressurized water like that, that's especially if you're all set up beforehand, that's brilliant. What was the hardest endurance race back then? Like, what was the hardest one to finish?
You know, I mean, Le Mans is so fast, and if you go back to before the chicanes, pre-90, you know, it was fast, but it was spread out and you were limited in how many cars you had. Daytona, when we did not run Daytona with lights, and you would have, you know, 75, 80 cars, and you have a lot of cars that were there, it was a battleground in the night. But the roughest from having the car had to be the big course at Sebring. You know, I mean, I'm not taking into consideration the big course of Nürburgring, but, you know, Sebring at one point, your ride height was almost an inch higher for Sebring than it was for Daytona. And so I remember, I think it was Jim Busby, in the BF Goodrich cars, you know, somebody's tailpipe came off And he drove over the 962 tailpipe and actually came up through the floor. Now, that could happen anywhere. But the beating, because Sebring, part of Sebring was built as the bomber base for World War II. So it's giant concrete slabs. Over time, it's just sitting on sand, and all these concrete slabs change. And when they made the track smaller and smoothed it out, Dr. Panos did, it took the character away, but it certainly changed the way that Sebring was. And a lot of guys like Audie, when Audie would come over, they would use Sebring as a test. You know, go do a 12-hour test at Sebring. You're good to go anywhere. You know, if the
just
car
to see what broke.
If the car can do 12 hours of Sebring, you know, it can do 24 hours any place else in the world. So, if you've got time, I got to tell one really funny story from Sebring in the old days.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So in 1981, I left Swap Shop after the 24 hour in 81. This was before the Miami Grand Prix that used to be between Daytona and Sebring. So I was trying to decide what to do. You know, single, you know, wanted to get on with a good team. So I wound up running the second car at Momo. For Jean-Pierre Moretti. And so I ran the second car there. So one, I can't remember if it was the practice, the night practice. I think it was the night practice. And the old straightaway, which was the runway, the only way that you knew, and you're doing, you know, let's say 175, 180 miles an hour going down that straightaway, and the only way you knew to turn, because there's so much surface, paved surface or concrete that was out there, was a cone. Well, somebody had clotted the cone and knocked it completely off.
Of course.
So, and again, no radios. So Jean Piero misses the right turn and goes shooting down the straightaway. And like three other cars following, you know, slower cars. So he says, I'm going and going. And you can imagine, you know, fortunately, the runway's for, and he says, all of a sudden, I realize the grass is like 5 feet tall. And I'm shooting, I'm still on. So I start slowing down and finally stop. And all these other cars stop around him. So he actually gets out of the car, climbs up onto the roof of the car to see where is the racetrack? So they see the lights where everybody is. So now this little train of cars turns back around and is now coming counter course onto.
No big deal.
Counter course with these guys coming at them. And then they all feed back into it. And I remember sitting at the pits and the car comes in and the roof's dented. You know, they had the 935s just a Porsche metal roof on it, and the roof's got dents in it. And we think initially, you know, what the hell went happened here? You know, he rolled over and just barely touched the roof and came back up. And so he comes out of the car. I go, doctor, what happened? And he goes, I must stand on the car to see where I must go. That was funny saying that, you know, it could never happen now. You know.
There was no catch fence or anything. It was just a cone.
Just keep on going, you know. Unfortunately, I had the presence of mind just to eventually stop the brake. So, you know, shot through the fence there across the highway and headed down to, you know, Tampa. So, or not Tampa, but Naples. But that was really one of the fun. I mean, that's why they had somebody, I think it was Bondurant, hit a wild pig.
Oh my gosh.
Wild pig, it wasn't anything to stop it. Here comes the wild pig, you know. And fortunately, in the Daytona, it's like hitting in a battleship. So, but it still didn't help it any.
No, that's bad for the car.
Yeah, it was bad. It's hitting a pig's like hitting a tree stump.
So. Yeah, Was that the founder of Momo, the guy who stood on the roof of the 935?
Yeah, Jean Piero.
Yeah. Didn't you catch him in a hauler one time?
He's passed on. We don't want to tell that story, but I had to stand guard. we had Penthouse as a sponsor.
Yeah, it was so a party over there, man.
Everybody wanted the black and gold Momo Penthouse. Jean Piero was one of the great, great characters of motor racing. He made pasta one day, every day, at every event. He would go and he and his wife, I think Daniele, he would make a big bowl of pasta and invited most anybody that came over. You know, it was more of a family. It wasn't as corporate as it is now. Would come over and you get a plate of pasta.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And that was just one of those things that he did there. But he really, when you would be around him, and you would have Claude Ballalena and Risi and Bob Wallach, maybe one of the German guys, and you would watch a conversation going on, and none of them would have a common language. And the conversation's going on in like three or four different languages. And you're just watching this bounce back and forth, and it's just blah, 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 blah. You know, somebody would speak French and they had to repeat it in Italian, and that would go to Spanish, and somebody would talk German. It was, yeah, he was a terrific, really a terrific guy. The amount of effort and money that he put into racing for so long helped develop a lot of cars. You know, he kept trying to find that unfair advantage, you know, putting the Buick turbo engine into an Alba at one point, and the Buick turbo without the restrictor in it made 1,000 horsepower.
Gee.
And the Alba was maybe like a C2 lights car kind of thing, and I think I don't remember if it was Price Cobb. Somebody drove the thing at Watkins Glen and did about 4 laps and came back in again and says, "Not me. Somebody else can get in that thing, but it's just that's going to kill. Somebody's not going home on Monday if we got to drive this thing in anger." But he did a lot of cool stuff. Really a terrific, terrific guy.
Were you at Le Mans when Paul Newman and Dickie Barber and somebody else won with that 935? They won their class. Hawaiian Tropic car, I think it was.
Yeah, they finished second. They finished second overall. Yeah, that was Jerry Woods. That's Marty Raffoff and Jerry. And basically, it was Dick Barber's car, but it was most of the guys there all worked for Gerritsen Enterprises out of Northern California. And that's how I wound up going to after the Sebring in 81. I had an opportunity to go to Gerritsen. It was the right decision. No, I wasn't there that year. That was the year 79 when the Winningtons won with the Kramer 935. I give full credit to Newman. You know, he was a terrific world star, but what little bit I was around him, because we had Ray Hall in 81, 82, and Bobby started doing Can-Am with him. Got to stand up on their motorhome with him at Riverside, I think. And just any interaction, the guy was a class act.
He seemed like he was about as much of a legit driver as you could get to and be a one of the most famous movie stars in the world.
I remember when I first started, I had a little Austin Healey Sprite, not a bug eye, like an MG Midget and quarter envelope body or whatever they called it. And we go to Moroso at Palm Beach, and PL was there. You know, he had the Bob Sharp 260Z or something that he was racing, and he won those. I think he won the championship. I believe he won the runoffs.
Yeah, he won the runoffs in a Z. Yeah, what year?
But I mean, he was, he was into it. He was, if you're, and he'd be, what I remember of him as well was in a short, you know, pair of shorts and you know, Dock Siders and a polo shirt and no entourage. You know, it's kind of like Dempsey in that respect. You know, when Patrick was racing with us before he started doing more of the European stuff and running the Mazda RX-8s, you know, he would sit there and help and watch the guys load the car. And I remember at Daytona when we did the Paul Revere before the NASCAR race the next morning, and we had to be out at like midnight, and Patrick would stay there till like 1 o'clock in the morning and come over to Mark Raffoff and myself. I was Rolex series manager at that point, and say, guys, I had a great time today. You know, I look forward to the next one. And he would have his helmet bag, you know, and his driver's suit in his hands and walk out into the dark. You know, yeah. Same deal. Very, very wanted to do it. We told him when he wanted to do some world championship stuff and go to Le Mans, and we told him, you should do it. You have an opportunity to do it. Do it now while you can do it. So,
yeah. Now, what made me think of that, of Paul Newman, was when you said the guy from MoMA would make spaghetti. And there were stories about Paul Newman. He would make food for everybody back when he was racing.
Yeah.
It sounded like a little bit more of a family rather than a business back then.
But you know, I would say it was more like a grid life event with older guys.
More of a party.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, cool.
I told somebody when working on this documentary thing, and I said at one point there used to be, and it wasn't a go-kart track, it was Malibu Grand Prix. And Malibu Grand Prix, you did one lap in this little formula car kind of thing. So it was like a hot rod go-kart, didn't shift, but you didn't get to race with other people. Well, there was one of these down in South Florida in Hollywood or Dania, Davie. And back in that period of like 80, 79, 80, you could go there on Tuesday night. And on Tuesday night, you would have Don Bill and Dale Whittington. You'd have Preston Hinn and his daughter, Bonnie, who was racing. You would have, you know, Marty Hines. You would have anybody that raced on the East Coast of South Florida migrated to that Malibu Grand Prix that night on Tuesday night. And it was
just a go-kart track.
Yeah, it was so fun. And you've got these major millionaire guys. I mean, Preston at one point flew over the track in his helicopter and took a photo of the track, because it was, I don't remember how many turns, so, you know, 28 turns or something like that, and had a big blow up in his office so that he could figure out what the best line, what the best line was. You know, nobody had Google Earth at that point. And it was so funny. And guys would be sitting there with the mechanics going, I want the big steering wheel. Here's $50. Go get new tires of the thing. So they were already back and forth trying to get that advantage. But you would never have that now.
Because they were playing time attack with their friends at the go-kart time track.
But it was the same guys that they would be banging doors with
at IMSA,
you know,
or whatever
the next week, you know.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it was terrific. It was terrific. Yep.
The times have changed a little bit, but it seems like it's that spirit lives on in some places, which is cool.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, the one thing that's come out of the whole virus thing right now is how the esports thing has really taken off. And yeah. I mean, from you guys doing it to F1 to Trans Am to SRO to NASCAR, everybody's got an esports thing. But I think the funny thing to me is that, and this is so typical, is you have guys that can drive the race car really fast, but can't drive the simulator.
Yeah.
You know, and you see this now with guys you've never even heard of that are winning. Or you see in the case of F1 with Leclerc, you know, here's a young kid that's grown up on the simulator and he can, you know, he can win. He can win driving the simulator. But, I think back to in 86 in Japan, they had this really terrific video game and it was the 24 hours of Le Mans, and you sat in the car, and at that point, whoever it was, Atari, whoever made the thing, had all the cars in the game were from the 1985 Le Mans. So you had, you know, the Yost car was in its yellow, white, and black. You had the American 100s. You had all these properly done cars. And as you would do laps in it, the sun would start to go down. It would get dark, and the lights would come on. And then you had to go through three or four laps at night, and then the sun would come up on the other side. And it was so funny because you had Hans Stuck. Again, this is the second time we're talking about Stuck. Stuck could not do a lap. And I remember, get out of this thing, and we're all sitting, all the teams are watching these guys, and they had all the top drivers there. And he'd get out and start swearing in Bavarian, Scheiß Klump,
One of the best drivers of all time. One of the best drivers
where I could not do a lap in a simulator.
That's awesome. It makes me feel better. I can barely get around a lap around Road Atlanta and iRacing.
The quality of the our engineer that we had at P1 actually now has a business. He has a fifth wheel, I think a 32-foot fifth wheel trailer, and has a very top level. I think Indy Lights just picked him up as the official simulator for Indy Lights. But the quality of the software and hardware for that is just so incredible. Any of the guys that we had, if I was running a top car, like when we had the Mercedes, two of the guys had never driven a Daytona before. And that's one of the things, Maxi Book, one of the top platinum guys, and Fabian Schiller, one of the silver AMG drivers. One of the things that we made sure before they ever showed up at the Roar was, have you been on the sim? Yep. Yep. We've done days and days and days on the simulator. So, other than feeling a little bump here or a little, the nuance of the track, or learning that where the hole gets on driver's left on the exit or the bus stop after, X amount of hours, learning that kind of stuff. But as far as knowing when to go left, when to go right, you've got to have it.
Even at a rudimentary level, it definitely helps. Like it helps fix all the problems that you normally have to solve the first five laps, at least,
Right. But we had Atlanta when the really top hyper car for Aston Martin, was it the Vulcan, I think, when the very first one showed up a couple of years ago, and they had two of the top Aston Martin drivers were with it. And I knew the head engineer and I had worked together years ago in England, and I came by Graham Humphreys, and I said, Graham, I had my truck there, our Chevy 1500, whatever. And I said, Graham, where's your drivers? I want to take them around and just give them a lap so they can see. And the two guys looked at me and they go, don't worry, mate. We've been on the simulator. We know what we're doing. And I said, I'm really going to insist. You've got a car here that, you can crank up to 850 horsepower, something. I'm really, just go along with me. So we leave the pits, we go up, go through six, and I'm doing, 50 miles an hour or something in this pickup truck. As we go through 10A in the chicane and we start to come up the bridge, I floor it, and I can see. Now we're coming up to the bridge, and I say I floor it. I came underneath the bridge at 60-something miles an hour, which in a friggin' pickup truck is pretty quick.
It's enough.
And I can see both of them, as most drivers, they don't want to have somebody else driving the car. And you see, his right hand going for the armrest on the door and all of that, and then go down the hill, and I slow down before I try to go 60 with the pickup truck through turn 12. And both those guys went, like Gordon Bennett, it's okay. That's completely different than the simulator is. And I says, okay, yeah, very much.
The rapid elevation change is something.
Let's do it. let's do another lap here, and then you guys get in your rental car. And they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and they did like 45 minutes in the rental car after that, just to get that feel for it. But
yeah, no, it's pretty accurate in iRacing, but like it's hard to describe the actual like feel of that. Those couple elevation changes at Road Atlanta, those are something.
I think it's racing on the simulator that instills the fear of that track to me, because I swear to God, every time I try and do it back in Road Atlanta, I crash turn 12. Every
That's why time. I put that second group of tires there with the, you know, the island.
Yeah.
You know, that's a bad place. That's a bad place. Boy, when we had the, not turn this into a Road Atlanta conversation, but the biggest thing that I feared was the historic Can-Am cars.
Yeah, and I believe it.
The bikes, I didn't care. You know, the bike guys are all tough. I mean, they're all, you know, 4 foot tall and made out of rubber and covered up in suits, you know, thick rubber and flexible, and they know what they're doing. You know, they're not a dentist or some guy that's gone out and bought a MK8 or something. And I remember the shadow car, I think the throttle stuck coming underneath the bridge, and he got down into the grass. And if it had not been for that secondary island pushing him in, we wound up having to cut him out and evac him into the helicopter.
Was that like 5 years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that real bad crash.
The sister car, I believe, crashed at Laguna. Actually came up and flew through the air. And so that's both those cars were hurt really bad. The driver, I believe Bennett, like a year and a half later, was driving again.
Yeah, it was a real bad crash. I remember a bunch of articles about that. Yeah,
yeah. We actually, he stayed conscious the entire time, but we actually had to cut him out of the car. Unfortunately, had a helicopter to get him out of there. But
yeah, it's a spooky place in a outdated, safety, ancient, super fast car.
But yeah. Yeah.
It's a spooky place in a Honda CRX, especially when your grass when it's your a spooky tire gets place in the grass.
We have one for 1500. You know.
Yeah. The first time I was there, I went down 12 and got my tire in the grass on the left, like second lap of the race.
Yeah.
It's cool.
All you gotta do is look where all the rubber goes. You know. You see all the rubber. You know. And we did a lot of addition of tire packs and changed them to FIA parallelograms, so the interlock, and did a lot of things there. But you know, that's part of it. I think that's one of the things that keeps the, especially the European drivers that come there that have never seen it, they really like that old school that Elkhart has, that Watkins Glen has, Lime Rock has, you know, Mid Ohio. You know, I mean, there's some of the old tracks that are not built. I mean, it's to beat up on COTA a little bit. I mean, you know, at COTA, with all the new Formula One, with all the paved runoffs that everybody's got, where, you know, there's you can do whatever you want to do, and except for control giving a track limits warning, you don't ever hit anything.
No, you can just drive wherever.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just like a difference in the amount of respect that has to be paid to the track, right? Like Road Atlanta, Road America, those places, you just like you go in and you realize as a driver make a mistake, it's going to be bad.
You know, and guys that have never raced on street tracks, you know, you run in Long Beach or Detroit or some of those places that we used to race at, the old original Miami Grand Prix. You know, those you know, you had. When you talk to the guys that were really good that could drive street tracks, he says, you have to forget that there's a concrete wall there. You know, you have to, I wouldn't drop my tire off in the grass. So you look at it with that same kind of mindset that, you know, if I had 10 feet of grass on the side in a prototype, I'm not going to drive with my tire in the grass. Now, you know, if you can straighten the corner out in a touring car, in a TC car or something, you're going to do that. That's part of the reason that little cars are hard to keep on the track because it's, they don't have to let off the gas and go shooting across 10 feet of grass. It'll take an opportunity to do that. But.
Yeah, it. I wouldn't want to crash a prototype at the bottom of 12. No thanks.
No
thanks. No. well, you're working on some documentary stuff. You probably can't talk much about it, but can you tell people what it might be about?
One on the documentary is actually kind of dealing with the let's call it, I'm using air quotes here, the cowboy days of IMSA. Back in the International Marijuana Smugglers Association. So there's one there that we're looking at. And then the other one is a potential docudrama. You know, there's a lot of there was a lot of great stuff that was going on in those days besides what was going underneath the radar, really underneath the radar. But it was a terrific time for racing and for teams. And we actually said to the producer the other day, there was actually almost a frat boy kind of attitude, you know. Where there was a lot of the same kind of camaraderie that I was talking about at the go-kart track. There was that same kind of thing at the racetrack. You know, it wasn't a big, heavy narco scene that was going on, you know, at that point at the track. But, and there were a lot of good guys. The guys that were involved that were racing against these guys, you know, the Bruce Levins and Bob Akins and Preston Hinton and those and Bob Al Holbert, those kind of guys were absolutely straight arrows, but everybody could still be friends, you know.
Yeah, there's some legendary drivers and teams that came out of that era, obviously.
Yeah, there were a lot of guys that made, you know, that did. It was a great place. Especially some of the European guys to come to the States, you know, and really see the environment that we had here. John Fitzpatrick's a perfect example of that. Nobody in the States knew who Fitz was till he came over in, I believe, 80 and cleaned everybody's clock.
Yeah.
You know, and been like, holy crap, look at this guy. Mm-hmm. You know? And, you know, he wasn't some 20-year-old kid, you know, that's been brought up in, you know, F3000. You know, he's a sports car guy, a, you know, 10-top guy.
But yeah, I hope that documentary happens. I want to see all the stories. I want to hear more about it.
Yeah, I do. I do, too. We're looking at 4 to 5 parts. We've shown there's a teaser reel.
Yeah, it's cool. I saw it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's really cool. We gotta adapt some of the cars on it stuff. But there's enough footage from that era, and they're talking to some of the TV people that have the original footage and to be able to use a lot of that stuff. So cool. We should know more.
You know, if you have something old like that, I can't think of a reason why you wouldn't want to, like, show, you know, it's just so cool.
It is. And nobody, you know, there's no place to go find that stuff anymore.
Yeah, some of it's not out there. It's not on the internet.
It's not out there. I mean, there's a little bit on YouTube, but most of it is crash stuff. You know, it just didn't exist. I mean, that's, you know, none of the... except for the guys that have been able to archive. I mean, Herb Branham runs the NASCAR archive, and they have access to a lot of the stuff down in Daytona and have been saving a lot of this, putting it into digital format. It's one of the things we talked about in Atlanta, because Atlanta also has a library, an archive, and they were trying to get a lot of that stuff sent down to Daytona. I mean, there was 8mm film of like the original first Trans Can-Am race.
Really?
Where we started going through some of this stuff. And, you know, there's Denny Holm in a t-shirt rolling tires. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you would just never, you know, you're never going to see. And most people don't give a rat's ass about it anymore, but there's still enough of us around that it's still part of the heritage. And at some point, if you're going to be involved in racing, you got to understand where it all came from a little bit.
Right. Right. All right. Well, we need to have Gary back on the next few weeks, especially if we're under quarantine. Gary's got too many stories.
Yeah, I think probably what we should talk about next time is your time with Wayne Taylor at the Super Trofeo program.
Yeah, you've had a couple cool years since you've been on the show. So
it's been interesting. I think the other thing as well that we ought to touch base. There's a bunch of stuff that we can touch base on, but going through what we all the races, all the 11 years at Le Mans. Some other stuff in DTM, and maybe even Paris Dakar. So
I forgot about that.
Ooh, that sounds cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, guys, great, great talking to you again.
You too, sir.
I really look forward to, we're going to get back to some normality here and go racing, and I hope to see you guys at our Grid Life events this year.
Yeah, we'll be there.
So. Yeah. Copy all right, that.
Guys. Can't wait. Right.
See you later. Yeah.
Bye bye.
See you, Gary.
Slip Angle was created by Austin Cabot and Adam Jubé, co-hosted by Derek Yarbrough, and production by Abram Schmucker, who mixes all of our terrible audio. If you like the show, please rate us and review us on iTunes, and come and find us in the pits at a Grid Life to say hello.